From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Democrats in control of key House committees are ramping up their investigations into the White House this week, which has rankled the president. This morning, he called the investigations presidential harassment, to which House Speaker Nancy Pelosi replied,
I am not commenting on what the president has to say about our work. I always think that whatever the president says about us, he's projecting his own unruliness. He's a projector. And that's what it's about.
NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson joins us now. And Mara, the president also called the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, a hack. You know, we wondered what Washington would look like post-midterm elections. Are we seeing it?
Well, sure. And when you have divided government, you get investigations. And the president doesn't want that to happen. The Republicans vigorously investigated President Obama. You could make a list of them. Fast and Furious, the IRS and Lois Lerner, Benghazi, the Obamacare website, Solyndra. This is what happens in divided government. Congressional oversight is more vigorous, and that is what the Democrats are going to do. And the president doesn't want them to, and he's going to try to fight them. But he's going to have to answer a lot of subpoenas. And the real trick for Democrats is, how are they going to investigate the president while at the same time pushing an affirmative legislative agenda in the House?
You know, we're going to get to that in one second. But the president, of course, maybe even have provoked this week, saying during his State of the Union Tuesday night that you can't have peace and legislation if there's war and investigation. And, you know, Democrats came right back saying there is going to be investigation. The chair of the House Intelligence Committee tweeting out, this is Adam Schiff after he was called a hack, I can understand why the idea of meaningful oversight terrifies the president. Several of his close associates are going to jail. Others await trial. Criminal investigations continue. We're going to do our job. Is this stepping up pressure on the White House?
Well, sure. But I don't think the president provoked this. The House Democrats were planning to do this before he gave the State of the Union address. And as a matter of fact, when he said that line, Nancy Pelosi's Twitter account, obviously it wasn't her, she was sitting right behind him on the dais, but Nancy Pelosi's Twitter account tweeted out, investigating and oversight is our constitutional responsibility.
Yeah. Look, the House Ways and Means Committee is also trying to get a hold of the president's tax returns. The chair can legally get the returns of any American from the IRS, but does this mean the public will see them?
That is not clear to me. President Trump is the first president who has not made his tax returns public. Yes, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee can get them, but what the committee does with them after that is not clear yet.
Yeah. Then there's the House Oversight Committee turning attention to the president's potential conflicts of interest. The House Judiciary Committee has prepared a subpoena for Matthew Whitaker, the acting attorney general, in case he doesn't appear at a hearing. Lots of things flying. Do Democrats risk looking overly partisan the way Republicans looked to many during the Obama administration?
Well, they're always going to look overly partisan to their opponents. But I do think it's a management problem for the new House Democratic majority. How do they do oversight, vigorous, constitutionally required oversight, while at the same time not making it look like that's all they're doing? They want to push a legislative agenda. Can they do that without letting these investigations kind of take over? I think it's absolutely possible, but it's something that has to be managed.
Yeah. Well, talk about one of the legislations they'd like to see. Another big story in D.C. today, House Democrats introducing a resolution for a Green New Deal. They want to make the country carbon neutral by 2030. They want much more government involvement. Don't just let the markets drive it. What is this telling us about where the party's going?
Well, it tells you that the Democratic Party has as a top priority doing something about climate change and trying to move to carbon neutrality. This is a resolution. The Green New Deal is not a bill. It's a resolution. So it's very broad. In many cases, it's very vague. But you're going to have a spirited debate inside the party and between the two parties about what are the best ways, whether they're market-based or government-led, to get to carbon neutrality or at least get to less dependence on carbon. No. Carbon tax rebate, where you put a tax on carbon, but then you cut a check for $1,400 to every single household in America every year. That's one idea you're going to hear debated. So I think it tells you the Democratic Party has this as a priority. The Republican Party does not. It's one of the big differences between the two parties. But exactly what practical solutions they want to put into legislation, I think, remains to be seen.
And Mara, your quick thoughts on Virginia, where you have a Democratic governor and attorney general both admitting to wearing blackface at one time in their lives, and an African-American lieutenant governor accused of sexual assault. Your thoughts?
Well, this is really incredible. And the Democratic Party has a lot of problems in Virginia. Of course, the president weighed in on Twitter today saying Democrats at the top are killing the great state of Virginia. If the three failing polls were Republicans, far stronger action would be taken, which is actually debatable since the Republican Party generally doesn't have the same zero tolerance about these issues that Democrats. But Democrats have to decide what are the standards for getting rid of someone. I think they've clearly expressed that blackface is unacceptable. They've called unanimously for the governor to step down. Whether the sexual harassment allegations against the lieutenant governor are enough to derail him, that is unclear.
And Piers Morilison, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, in his State of the Union address on Tuesday night, President Trump said that unemployment for Americans with disabilities has reached an all-time low. But critics say many people with disabilities have given up looking for work, so the president's remarks don't paint the full picture. Another problem that people with disabilities face is quality, affordable housing. Nationwide, it's estimated that 80% of adults with developmental or intellectual disabilities live with their families. Phoebe Petrovic from Wisconsin Public Radio reports on a group of parents who are trying to help their adult children with disabilities find housing tailored to their needs.
On a Tuesday in Mount Horeb, Wisconsin, five women have gathered around a cafe table crowded with coffee cups and thick binders.
Why don't you talk about your homework?
So my homework is...
Today they're talking about grant applications. Some are specific.
Oh, here's the one. Do not use grant funds on posters and excessive begging.
The group needs to raise $500,000 to help build an apartment complex they're calling Home of Our Own. These parents and grandparents all have adult children with disabilities who still live with them. The group's leaders, Marianne Omakin and Susan Wallach, met over 20 years ago when their children, Amy and Frank, were in preschool. Amy and Frank both have autism and are nonverbal. Wallach says she and Omakin often spoke about their children's futures.
What happens when our children grow up, and where are they going to live, and what are their lives going to look like? Because we know these are not going to be children who are going to be independent someday.
Amy and Frank are now in their mid-20s and still live with their parents. But Omakin knows their children can't live with them forever.
Let's face it, we are going to die one day. And we would much rather plan thoughtfully and to not have the planning be driven by a crisis.
The parents worry about what will happen when they're no longer able to care for their children. And they say they don't want to put them in group homes or isolated apartments, worrying it might expose them to abuse. People with intellectual disabilities experience sexual assault at a rate 7 times that of those without disabilities, according to data from the U.S. Department of Justice obtained by NPR. So Omakin says that for the past 6 years, the families behind Home of Our Own have met weekly in this cafe, trying to figure out how to build a place where their children can live on their own, safely and affordably, among friends and neighbors in rural Wisconsin.
This is a really, really determined set of parents, and we just refused to give up.
They dreamed up a specific plan, an integrated community in New Glarus, a small town nearby that would welcome residents of all abilities and incomes. Disability advocates, nonprofit developers, and state officials all say there is a shortage of affordable, accessible housing in Wisconsin. And it's nationwide, says Nicole Jorwick, director of rights policy at the ARC of the United States, which advocates for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
And it's something that families all over the country who have family members with disabilities worry about on a daily basis.
California and Oregon have developments similar to Home of Our Own, affordable apartments where people with and without disabilities can live together. But across the country, more than 500,000 people are on wait lists for Medicaid services that could help them gain access to housing and support. Dorwick says the need is so much larger than a few innovative housing models. And that's true here in Wisconsin, according to David Ginger. He oversees the allocation of tax credits for affordable developments for the state.
I suspect I could allocate all my tax credits to supportive housing for the next couple of years and still not make a huge dent into the need.
Home of Our Own has applied for those tax credits, which would largely cover the $8 million project. They have secured a plot of land and drawn up building designs. Omikin says they're getting closer.
Oh my gosh. In some ways, it feels like this has been the longest journey of our lives. But in other ways, it feels like all of a sudden it's moving really quickly.
It's been tough, but Susan Wallach, the group's other leader, says their children have kept them going.
Our children are the most amazing teachers, and they're the most remarkable people. And if we are strong, it is because our children have taught us to be strong.
If the parents succeed, they'll create 40 new homes in Wisconsin. But advocates say there are still thousands of adults with disabilities who need quality, affordable, accessible housing. And to answer that need, it'll take more than just a few dedicated parents. For Here and Now, I'm Phoebe Petrovic.
If you're looking at your smartphone right now, you might want to listen to this next story. According to the consulting firm Deloitte, most Americans say they're on their phones too much. And our next guest wants people to rethink how and why we use digital devices. Cal Newport is author of the new book, Digital Minimalism, Choosing a Focused Life in a Noisy World. It's out this week. He's an associate professor of computer science at Georgetown University. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
And when we think about things that people are addicted to, you think of drugs or alcohol, you argue that a lot of us are actually addicted to social media and to our devices.
That's right. It's a different type of addiction that you would have with a substance. It's what a psychologist would call a moderate behavioral addiction, which means if you have it around, you're probably going to use it more than is healthy.
Has it always been like that since we've had smartphones, or do you think it's gotten to a level that it's much worse than before?
Well, it's definitely gotten worse. A big part of this is that the user experience of social media was re-engineered so that it would foster more compulsive use. So Facebook 10 years ago is an experience that's very different than Facebook today. 10 years ago, you're looking at your friends' profiles. Mm-hmm. Today, it's this unending stream of rich rewards, likes and tags and comments that are coming at you all day long that you have to keep compulsively checking.
You point out, actually, that they changed the color of the notification alert from blue to red because it sets off an alarm bell in your head. Oh, I've got to check something.
Yeah, the designer said, of course, this should be within our palette, so it should be blue. But the attention engineer said, you know, if it's alarm red, people are going to click more. More clicks is more user engagement minutes. More user engagement minutes is more revenue.
And what does that do to us, the user?
Well, the main complaint I've been hearing from people is the sense that they're losing autonomy. By which I mean this idea that they have to keep going to the phone more than they think is useful, more than they think is healthy, to the exclusion of things they know are more important, makes it feel like they're losing control over what they're doing with their time and what they're doing with their life.
What are we losing? What are we missing out because of that?
Well, we're missing out on many of the activities that historically we need to flourish as human beings. So something as simple as solitude. That is just time alone with your own thoughts to reflect and think about things that are important, or just simple real-world analog conversation where you could sit across from someone and see how their body language shifts. These basic activities, which is crucial to a flourishing, functional human life, we're omitting them as we spend more and more time just tending this digital stream.
And you point out that one of the reasons for that is because when we look at a new app, for example, we only think about the benefit. We don't think about the cost. And good old Henry David Thoreau would have said, think about the cost.
Exactly. Thoreau was a great minimalist. And he had this idea that if you just look at the benefits, you become a maximalist. So you're always just trying to maximize the number of these little benefits that you've accrued. But in doing that, you miss what are the cost, what do you actually have to pay to get these benefits. And in particular, he said, what is the cost in terms of your life energy, your life force, time you could be spending on something more important? So the maximalists think they're better off because they're hunting down all these small scraps of value. But what they're really missing out on is the great satisfaction that comes from taking that energy and consolidating it on the small number of things that you know for sure are really important to you.
Okay, so we've laid out the problem, and I bet a lot of our listeners are thinking to themselves right now, oh my God, what am I going to do about this? I'm addicted to my device. So let's shift focus here and talk about some of the solutions that you talk about in this book. And one of them is to give up everything for 30 days.
Yeah, start from scratch. Clear it all out. Step away for 30 days. Get back in touch with what you really care about, what you want to spend your time on. And then when you're done with the 30 days, rebuild that digital life from scratch, but do it this time with real intention.
That's got to be really hard to do, though, to give it all up for 30 days in this modern world.
It sounded hard to me. So when I put a call out to my readers to say, hey, who wants to do this experiment? I thought maybe 20 or 30 people would volunteer. Instead, 1,600 people signed up to spend the month of January 2018 without this technology. Mm-hmm. And that's what told me, yeah, it's hard. But the way that we're living now is even harder. People are hungry and ready for a change.
And you say that in the first couple of weeks, it was very hard. And then they kind of thought, maybe this is not such a bad thing.
One young woman told me that during the first week, she was so used to checking her phone for new information that after she took all of the apps off for this declutter, she found herself compulsively checking the weather app because it was the last thing that was left on there that you could click on and maybe get some new information. But after about 10 days, 14 days, that went away. And most people reported that by the time they got to the end of the 30 days, they had really lost their taste for having this low-quality, always-on digital stream being a part of their life.
Right. Well, there is a level of boredom that you would be afraid of. These days, when you're standing in line at the supermarket, you know, you can pull out your phone and get caught up on what's happened, but you wouldn't be doing that in the world that you're describing.
Boredom is really important in my world. I mean, having on a regular basis time where it's just you alone with your thoughts, just observing what's going on, thinking about the random things that pop into your head. This might sound intolerable to the modern smartphone sort of infected individual, but it's absolutely crucial to resetting your mind, to having insights, to having successful self-reflection. And so boredom is good. You know, someone was telling me today about how they remembered fondly when you were at the bar waiting for your friend to get there. And the conversations you would have with just the random person next to you or talking to the bartender, there's just something social and connecting about that we forget how those simple things really went a long way to humanizing the people around us.
And now we would just look down at our phone if we're sitting there at the bar waiting for somebody.
We all do. And what we don't recognize is how recent and arbitrary this is. This notion that a smartphone needs to be a constant companion. Something that you look at all day long like an air traffic controller, managing this influx of information and sending your missives out into the world. We're used to that. But to someone who was, let's say, going in a time machine from 7 years ago, would look at this and say, this is really unusual. What are you guys doing?
What about the idea that on a network like Facebook, we're able to stay in touch with hundreds of people that we've known in our lives and know when they have a baby or when they're going on vacation or whatever, and that we wouldn't be able to do that if we didn't have something like that?
I think that's okay. I think this notion that you need to know that someone that you met 25 years ago just had another kid, that this is somehow crucial to be social, it just doesn't match the history of human sociality.
What if somebody is listening and they think, I can't do 30 days without my device. Is there something less intense that I can do?
Well, there's two exercises you could do to essentially warm up for the big event, which is the 30-day break. And so the two exercises I recommend is one, take off your phone any app in which someone makes money every time you click on it. You don't have to quit the services. You can still access them on your laptop or desktop. You just don't have them with you throughout the day. My second recommendation is start working on reintroducing the type of high-quality analog leisure activities that we used to fill our time with. So when the time comes to actually step away from technology and start from that blank slate and rebuild your digital life, you're not going to be staring into the abyss. You're going to know what you want to do with your time and be excited about it.
Well, you actually talk in this book about somebody who took a break from digital devices and managed to read, what, 6 books in a couple of weeks or 8 books in a couple of weeks?
A lot of people gave me a similar story. People kept sending me tallies, their book tallies. They were so proud, but they were also really happy about it because they forgot how satisfying that is to go deep on something as opposed to just skimming, swiping, and tapping.
You say some people actually go for the old-fashioned flip phone just to try to minimize the amount of time they spend on the phone.
This is becoming more popular. It's interesting. I've been reporting on this some. This is now a trend, this notion that you have a simple flip phone. There's some new ones that they're building which look really nice. You could text message on them. You could take phone calls, and that's it. And people are reporting back to me that when you cut off that digital stream that's constantly pulling at your attention and you're just there in the world, it's like you're living a completely different style of lifestyle. So I'm not surprised that this trend is starting to spread again.
Cal Newport, I'm going to make a prediction right now, which is that if we were to play this interview again in 2 years, we'd still be facing the exact same issues that you're talking about right now. Why is it so hard for us to fix this problem?
Well, I'm not sure if your prediction is going to come true because something I've noticed, and I've been writing and talking about this for years and years, is that there's something different in the air right now. I mean, people used to tell self-deprecating jokes about how much they use their phone, but when they would meet me and find out I didn't use social media, they would think I'm weird. This has really changed. Something's in the air. I think people are finally getting fed up with how much of their humanity they're losing to always staring at these screens. And so my more optimistic prediction is that we have become so tired of how enslaved we've become that we are going to revolt. And so if we came back 2 years from now, my hope is what we would be saying is, can you believe that we ever used to live that way?
Well, and one of the things that really makes you think in this book is you bring up people like Martin Luther King and the idea that solitude was actually very important to him being able to think some of his most important thoughts.
Well, this is one of the biggest unintended consequences of what we've engineered in this digital age is that it's made it possible to banish completely time alone with your own thoughts. Mm-hmm. This is a huge novelty in human history, and it's not good for us. And so, yeah, I do go back and retell the story of Martin Luther King's kitchen table conversion experience, because for him, like for everyone, time alone with your thoughts is where real self-development, self-reflection, and progress is made. You have to put in those hours of just thinking about yourself, your life, and what you're all about if you want to get anywhere worth going.
That is Cal Newport, who is the author of the new book, Digital Minimalism, Choosing a Focused Life in a Noisy World. Don't try to find him on Twitter. He's not there. Cal, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
How do deaf babies learn? The thinking has always been infants overcompensate for their lack of hearing skills with increased visual skills. But that may not be true. A new study from The Ohio State University finds that deaf babies take longer to process visual stimuli than hearing babies, and it happens early. Dr. Claire Monroy is a postdoctoral fellow of otolaryngology, that's the study of ear, nose, and throat, at The Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center. She's also the co-author of the study. Dr. Monroy, welcome.
Thank you.
This isn't a negative finding. This is just a new and different finding. What is the finding?
So what we found is that young infants in the first year of life who are deaf take longer to habituate to visual stimuli that has no auditory component at all. It takes them longer to process and encode information that's purely visual.
Yeah. So you did what? You had babies looking at a screen at images?
Yeah, so we had little babies sitting on their parents' lap, and they would look at a novel object, so just an animated, completely made-up thing that looked something kind of like a toy. And then when babies get bored with something, when they've looked at it long enough that they've encoded everything that there is to encode, they will look away. We then will get their attention back and show them the same object again. And we continue to do this until their rate of decline in how long that they're willing to look reaches a certain threshold. And then that amount of time is what we call the habituation criterion.
Right. And you found that deaf infants were looking longer. Could it be that they're just more curious?
That's one possibility that's actually part of an ongoing debate. And we did take a close look at the data and see whether it could be the case. But all of our analyses all converge in showing that they really seem to be taking longer, most likely because they're processing this information more slowly.
Do I understand, too, that children with hearing loss, they will learn simple words, cat, five, far sooner than abstract words, you know, go, things like that? But does that even out over time?
So that's complicated. For deaf babies, their kind of trajectory of language development is very different. And it also really depends on so many factors, from how long the period of deafness before they got some kind of access to sound, like from a hearing aid or a cochlear implant, and what kind of input that they get from their parents and from the environment. That's one of the challenges, is understanding all of that variability and how that has implications for how they're going to learn and when.
What else would you say to parents? I mean, you know, give infants time with things, but how else would they, or doctors or teachers, use what you've learned?
I think that this particular research study really opens up more questions than it necessarily answers. So for us, it's kind of a starting point where we found this new evidence showing differences in cognitive development from early in infancy. That's something that, you know, we didn't know before. And so what are the underlying mechanisms driving those differences, and what does that mean for future research?
That's Dr. Claire Monroy, co-author of a recent study on deaf children and their ability to learn. She's also a postdoctoral fellow of otolaryngology, the study of ear, nose, and throat at The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. Doctor, thank you.
Thank you.
The people of Virginia are still wondering today what is going to happen to the state's top leaders. Two of them, Democratic Governor Ralph Northam and Democratic Attorney General Mark Herring, have admitted to dressing in blackface decades ago. The Democratic Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax is facing sexual assault allegations. None has resigned. Many of the revelations come from a conservative news site called Big League Politics. Now, there are political questions, but there's also shock in and outside of Virginia that these politicians did this. Joining us now is Ed Ayers, a historian at the University of Richmond, who's also a host of the podcast Backstory. Ed, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
So first of all, it is surprising to a lot of people outside Virginia that there are so many people who would have dressed in blackface, worn a Klan uniform, even as a joke. Was it surprising to you?
Well, it's surprising to a lot of us who've lived here for a long time as well. It's very disheartening. But I would say, as a historian of the United States, it's not surprising, because this has been one of the most popular forms of white people entertaining one another for generations in this country. You know, in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, minstrelsy, which was very often white men corking up to pretend to be black or exaggerated versions of African-American, was one of the most best guarantees of pulling in a large audience. And then after that kind of fades in the late 19th century, it becomes sort of a folk art among white people who are getting together in places where they completely control things. So you'd find all kinds of, you know, civic clubs would have an annual event that they would dress up in blackface, also, of course, in drag. There is that as well at the same time. So you would have found this in the same way the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s is very popular in many parts of the United States far outside the South. So you would have found this kind of blacking up very common through a lot of the 20th century.
But what about like the 1980s? Doesn't that surprise you?
Well, it does. You know, by that time, you know, I'm a college professor, and I couldn't have imagined that this would have been the case.
Right.
But my friend Jamal was actually playing music in front of those people, and I believe he has stories that suggest this might not be as big a surprise to him.
Well, let me bring you in, Jamal. This is Jamal Milner. You're a 1993 graduate at the University of Virginia. You're an audio engineer there. Tell us what you've experienced.
Okay, well, in that era, I was in lots of bands that were playing fraternity parties, and particularly the white fraternities. And I would often be one of the only African Americans in the room. And I'm not saying like at every party this would be the case, but there would be more than one occasion a year where there would be a costume type function, obviously Halloween, but sometimes there would be other functions throughout the year. And basically what would happen, at least one person would have blackface, maybe an Afro wig with it, or blackface with a dreadlock wig and hat. And this is, you know, approximately from I was in college and as a musician between like 1989 and about 1996, traveling throughout the entire South. So I don't want to throw Virginia under the bus because I observed this also at other Southern universities, University of Alabama, mm-hmm. Auburn's, University of South Carolina's. So it wasn't at white fraternities unusual for at least someone during a Halloween or a costume party to dress as an African-American.
And what did you think when you saw that?
I'm looking at it now reflectively. I didn't like it, but I didn't say anything to them because often, like I said, I was probably the only black person in the building that wasn't maybe one of their employees.
Did you feel that they were making fun of you?
I thought they were making fun of black people writ large, not me specifically. They didn't know that I would be there probably.
And what did you think when you saw all of the news about Ralph Northam or now the Attorney General of Virginia dressing up in blackface a long time ago?
Well, again, I wasn't surprised. I think, unfortunately, this is going to be similar to the Me Too, that there are going to be lots of people who were at parties or who did these things. And usually, unfortunately, fraternities are the gateway to power. So mm-hmm. these will be people in positions in our government or in corporations. I think Governor Northam could have apologized the first day, and I would have understood. I don't think, you know, that's great or that it's awesome that he did it. But as after he tried to rectify the situation, he definitely lost my support.
Ed Ayers, what kind of stuff do you think that this drags up for people in Virginia and across the South?
Well, as people may know, Virginia has been led by Democratic governors and senators and recently presidential electors for a while. And people have thought that, well, Virginia is kind of seceding from the South in mm-hmm. some ways, you know. And, you know, recently got the Amazon headquarters in Northern Virginia. So there's been a kind of amnesia in Virginia that we've forgotten that we were the largest state for enslaved population and that we had this history of segregation and massive resistance and all this. So, you know, like Jamal, I think those of us who think about this for a living or experience this world are not necessarily surprised, but we're very disheartened. The people who have been caught up in this seem to be leading us in such a healthy direction and actually confronting issues of race in a way that has not been the Virginia way. You know, Lieutenant Governor Fairfax stepping off the dais when, you know, Robert E. Lee is celebrated struck me as a, you know, a brave and quiet protest mm-hmm. against what other people would just see him as harmless. I think that's the big discovery, is that so many white people for so long just did not have the capacity to understand the larger cost of this kind of behavior, thought that it was harmless. And I think people now see that there's harm radiating in lots of different directions.
What do you think is going to happen next? Do you think that if we were to talk in a month that the same people will still be in power in Virginia?
You know, you wish you could say that understanding the past gives you some light into the future, but this just seems so out of the blue and so consequential. It's overwhelming, really. For those of us who think about this stuff for a living, to mm-hmm. see things that we've been saying, really, folks, you got to remember, this has been going on. Suddenly to see it thrust into the light is a kind of a perverse satisfaction of saying, we told you this was real and not gone. But I kind of like Jamal, I don't want to throw the state under the bus. Virginia has been, you know, changing so rapidly, mm-hmm. and you can see so many forces for good that it's especially heartbreaking to see this reversal.
And Jamal, what do you think is going to happen, and what do you want to happen now?
Again, I'm with Ed. If I could prognosticate, I would probably use it for valuable things like the Super Bowl next year. It's very difficult. I don't even know in civics who shows up after the Attorney General.
It's the Speaker of the House of Delegates. I looked it up. Yeah.
Who's Republican?
Who's Republican? Right. So they
and who was selected by a lot after a narrow.
Right. Oh, that's right. He won by like one vote. Or
yeah,
whatever,
that's right.
So this is just showing, I guess, we will see how powerful our democracies are.
Well, what strikes me beyond the personalities involved is that it was widely expected that Virginia was getting ready to turn Democratic throughout the General Assembly as well. So on the national level, it's been there for a while. But what was it going to mean for things like the debates over Confederate memorials and all that when the Democrats control the entire General Assembly? So I think the interesting question is going to be, what are the reverberations of this for the future of the entire Commonwealth politically?
Well, and Jamal, let me just come back to you one more time and push you on this question. What do you want to happen? Do you want Northam to go?
I do right now, yes, because only the again, he killed himself saying he used brown shoe polish as opposed to black and described the effects of the black shoe polish. Well, I've only gotten black shoe polish on my hands polishing my shoes.
And what about the Attorney General Mark Herring? Do you want him to
Mark Herring, I mean, again, I can think of this if I were in the biblical way, again, the Saul to Paul kind of conversion. Someone could have had very abhorrent and terrible views and then some point come around and then prove their new philosophy via their works. I think Mark Herring, in my opinion, may be able to do that, but I only speak for me.
That is Jamal Milner, who is an audio engineer there in Virginia, graduate of the University of Virginia, and Ed Ayers, historian at the University of Richmond. Thanks to both of you for talking with us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you.
Let's talk baseball. Baseball is bound by tradition, but there's moves afoot to make some fundamental changes. New restrictions on pitching changes, for instance, a push for a designated hitter in the National League. Right now, the American League has the DH, a player that does nothing but hit, just comes in, maybe drives a few players on base home. Think the Seattle Mariners' Edgar Martinez, who's going into the Hall of Fame, or the Red Sox' David Ortiz, who should be. Both the DH. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
And so why is this happening now, changes in particular?
I love the word bound by tradition because it has a couple senses, right? One can be constricted and restrained, but another one is how a covenant might bind you. And baseball looks at its history, how it is bound to history, how there are ties to how they've always done things. And so it's in some respects very hard not to do things that way. On the other hand, games are getting longer. Revenue is falling off slightly. Attendance is definitely falling off. And baseball knows that it doesn't have the scintillating, fast-twitch muscle fiber product that the American consumer of 2019 wants.
Right.
So it's trying to be a little, I'm not going to say proactive, because we're going by rules that were codified in the 1800s, right? But at least a little more proactive than they've been.
They want the tweets of baseball. But we understand also management is worried about, there's been a drop in offense. Strikeouts exceeded hits for the first time last year, and the batting averages dropped to the lowest. I mean, it's become a pitcher's game. And just take this up for a second, because I know there are changes seriously being considered. There was a pitch clock, right, being considered move things along?
I do like that. I like a lot of these changes, some of the other ones we could talk about.
Yeah.
But just taking so much time between pitches, how is that entertaining? It's the antithesis of entertainment. So a pitch clock does – the fact that baseball has no clock, literally has no clock, is one of the appeals of it. It is a pastoral sport and, it goes just by innings. But if you looked at how much time is taken between pitches, we have footage of games from the 1940s and 50s. It was a lot less time.
Yeah.
So come on, guys, let's speed it up a little.
Well, is that being considered seriously? I thought it was dropped. Is it still
it's technically dropped. Like, no one's going to actually, in between innings, there is a clock. So an umpire is not going to keep time, although in some college games they do. But the umpires will, and have been, and this is a point of emphasis, have been told that if they sense that things are dragging, and maybe they could do it just from an internal clock, they could tell the pitcher to hurry up.
Okay, but what changes are seriously being considered?
The DH for both leagues,
right,
which is the player who is his only job is to bat. And that is, it is weird because that's one of those traditional things that if you are a fan of the National League, you always have your pitchers bat. And I enjoy pitchers batting, but no other league in the world besides the National League allows that. And that's also, this is very interesting because players and owners are at each other's throats these days over issues like free agency. And that's something that the owners could do that would probably probably help them or at least not hurt them, that the players want, because the players' union points to the fact that, you know, the DH will be a veteran who's played for years. They see it as more of a jobs opportunity. So that could be the sort of change we get that comes because of labor peace. Another change they're talking about, and I think this fundamentally changes the game, is in extra innings, maybe to start with a runner on second base, and they do this in women's softball. But really, I know you could say that's not baseball about anything, you know, like don't tell the guys not to spit. That's not baseball. But starting with a guy on second really is not baseball.
I'm sorry. That's crazy. But on the other hand, these games are so long. But then on still the other hand, I mean, that's part of...
You're a switch hitter here is what you're saying.
No, yes, I am. Because that's part of the mythology. You can say, I stuck it out till 2 a.m., you know. So, but the idea is that you have somebody start on second base. I'm sorry. Which seems so silly, so that you might get runs in sooner.
Yes. Yeah. Although, you know, of all the problems with baseball, the literal problem of extra inning games is not much of a problem. Thomas Boswell, who's one of the best baseball writers out there, says something. He writes that the first time I see a free runner on second base will be the time I might decide that soccer has become my favorite sport. And this is a guy who loves baseball. And is also, by the way, in favor of most of the other rules, because the way he sees it, if you love baseball, you want the game to be popular and the game to grow. So, you know, you might want things like a DH in both leagues if this will cause labor peace and the game to be slightly more appealing. You certainly want the game to speed up a little more.
Yeah.
I know a very few people who say, oh, baseball should be a little bit slower. I mean, the average game is over 3 hours, which is longer than almost everything in our society when you think about it.
Okay, real quick. Spring training starts. Yay, matter a couple days. 90 free agent players still on the market and some of the best in baseball. What's going on, briefly?
It could be collusion. The owners have colluded in the past. There's also a market explanation for, even though guys like Bryce Harper and Manny Machado are so good, they might make their teams better, that doesn't necessarily translate into the pockets of owners since they have to share revenue. I expect these guys will get signed for tens of millions of dollars, but maybe not multiples of 10.
Mike Pesca, you're now sports analyst, host of the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. And let's repeat, spring training starts in a few days. Mike, thanks.
You're welcome.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.